You know, one of the things about preparing a sermon on any passage is that you discover how rich the Bible is again. And so looking at this passage this week, I found myself wanting to retitle the message. So unfortunately, you won't have the delight of hearing Matter Matters with Matt. Instead, I've titled today's passage, Jesus Confronts Our Narrowness. Because Jesus, in this passage in particular, is about making us uncomfortable, confronting the things that we might hold most closely, and yet in the midst of that, calling us to Him. But before we get that, I want us to zoom out a little bit to get the scope of what Luke's doing in this story. Because when we stay just in an individual passage, it's easy to forget that Luke is actually telling a much bigger story, painting a much bigger picture. And last week, we looked at Luke 8. Today, we're in Luke 13 or 14. So there's about five chapters, and there's two key events that I want to draw our attention to in Luke chapter 9. First, Jesus asks his disciples in that chapter, "Who did the crowds say that I am?" And they answer, not surprisingly, with a variety of answers. Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others are just kind of confused and say, he seems to be one of the great prophets of old. And then Jesus turns and he says to the disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter, in one of the climactic moments in the book of Luke, he says, "The Christ of God, the Messiah, the one who has come to save us." And this is a climactic moment because the first half of Luke is concerned primarily with communicating Jesus' identity as this Messiah. He's done many signs and wonders. He's proclaimed that he himself is here to set the captives free. And so this is all in keeping with the messianic idea, the idea that this is one who's come to save Israel. But then the second fascinating thing happens right after Peter has confessed that he is the Christ of God. Jesus tells them this: "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised." See, Luke until this point has painted a picture of Jesus as the Messiah, but now we find out this Messiah is going to be killed. And so, in Luke 9:51, Jesus turns his face, he sets his face towards Jerusalem. And Luke will repeatedly, throughout the rest of the narrative, until Jesus comes to Jerusalem, reference this journey. And it's because Luke wants us to keep in mind that the stakes are rising, that tensions are getting more heated, and that Jesus is on his way to the cross. And so even in the midst of chapter 13, in between the two passages that Sarah read so wonderfully for us, Luke tells us that Jesus went on his way through towns and villages, teaching and journeying towards Jerusalem. So I want us to understand our passages today in light of this broader picture that Luke is painting. See, it's a thrilling story he's telling. It's one of prophecy and fulfillment, of acceptance and rejection, of death and resurrection. And that all makes for a pretty good story, I hope you agree. But now, as Jesus is traveling towards Jerusalem, we get a feeling that things are heading toward a breaking point. This is the point in the movie where the music starts to swell. You start to get a sinking feeling that if they go in that house, something bad's going to happen. And we can see just up ahead, just around the corner, things are about to go bad for Jesus. Things are going to get ugly. So in light of this, let's turn to our passages today. And beginning with the first one, we are told that Jesus is teaching on the Sabbath. Not really a surprise. Luke's recorded multiple times where he's done this before. And the Greek here implies a habitual activity. This is something he would regularly do. Which makes me ask, why share this story, Luke? Why this case of Jesus teaching on the Sabbath? And we quickly find out that it's because there is a woman here, a woman who has been crippled for 18 years, bent over. And we know basically nothing about this woman. There's no mention of her faith or any sort of prerequisites for Jesus coming to heal her, which makes me think that this is not just a healing for the sake of healing. And you'll note that, in fact, Luke doesn't tell us that Jesus ceases to teach to go and heal. So I think what Luke is suggesting is that this is Jesus using a perfectly teachable moment. And all the children and all the parents, I'm sure, are well familiar with teachable moments. And the moment here, in particular, has to do with the Sabbath. One commentator on this passage writes about the Sabbath that at this point in Jewish history, it was a day of rest that humans, by instituting ever more meticulous legislation, had belabored into a day of greater difficulties. How ironic, right? They'd taken a relatively simple teaching about the Sabbath as a day of rest and added and added and added to it, making the kind of activity that you could do more and more narrow. And so when Jesus heals this woman, the ruler of the synagogue protests not to Jesus, but to the crowd. Jesus quickly shuts him up, though. You see, this woman is infinitely more valuable than any ox or donkey. But you can feel the tension here, because in verse 17, we get two radically different responses to Jesus. While all his adversaries were put to shame, the people rejoiced at all the glorious things that were done by him. There's a tension here. The stakes are rising. Things are about to go bad. And this tension is carried into our second passage. See, the Pharisees in verse 1 of chapter 14 are said to be looking very carefully at Jesus. And this isn't just sort of like a gaze or they're interested. The language here implies some sort of a trap. This is, hey, Jesus, come over to our meal. And, oh, Jesus, look, there's a man here who needs healing that we happen to invite. And, oh, look, Jesus, it happens to be the Sabbath. What are you going to do? It's a trap. And Jesus, of course, springs the trap the opposite way, shaming them once more as they're forced to be silent. And for the original readers, in fact, this moment of the Sabbath meal was supposed to be a moment of intimate communion. You see, so for the first readers, this is awkward. They'd be squirming. This is inviting the vegetarian to your house and only putting meat on the table. This is tense. It's uncomfortable. It's certainly not intimate communion. But I think this begs the question, why is this tension here? Is it that the Pharisees and the ruler of the synagogue just hate to see people healed? They just hate it? I don't think that's it. In fact, I think rather the tension is here because Jesus is inviting people to a freedom while the religious leaders are bound and marked by narrowness. It is as if they have blinders on. It's as if God has said, here's a whole park to play in. Here's grassy fields and a playground and a swimming pool, and the Pharisees are in the corner playing in the mud. And if anyone else, what's more, comes into the park, the Pharisees say, no, you can't go to any of that. Come here and play in the mud with us. Oh boy, can we identify with them on that, I hope. Actually, I don't hope, but I think it's true. In particular, in our passage, we see their narrowness come out in two different ways. And with regards to time and schedules, and with regards to rules. And if there are two things that keep our society running, it's time and it's rules. See, we set up times to meet each other. We block out our schedule according to hours. Once a year, we even lose an hour of sleep so that the time on our clock faces will match up with the natural cycles of light. And rules function in the same way. They give us structure. They tell us what to do and what not to do. Some of us admittedly like them more than others. But certainly none of us want to live without them completely. And they can be good and valuable things, time, schedules, and rules, certainly. And we wouldn't want to get rid of them. But they can threaten to become idols in which they attract our attention more than the living God. Consider our schedules for a moment. And the ruler of the synagogue certainly had a schedule. You see, he turns to the people in verse 14 and tells them, look, you have all these opportunities to come and be healed. Just don't do it on the Sabbath. And there's certainly something logical about this, right? Why not come on a different day? Why does Jesus have to heal on this day? Why not wait till tomorrow? I mean, it's been 18 years for this woman. What's 18 years and one more day? See, the ruler of the synagogue sees Jesus as acting at the fundamentally wrong time. And this is our tendency too, isn't it? If it didn't make our calendars, if it isn't on our phones, then too often Jesus isn't welcome. We may believe that we ought to dedicate our time to the Lord, but what that ends up looking like is 15 minutes spent in Bible or prayer reading and maybe an hour on Sundays. And what we end up doing is actually pigeonholing Jesus into a time slot. He becomes just another moment in our day rather than filling our day. And this is where the confrontational Christ, the Jesus of our passage, comes in and says, enough! See, he will not have this. To be a disciple is not about giving part or a portion, but about giving it all. And Jesus demands it all. He demands that we get onto his schedule. Be honest, it doesn't always feel that much like a schedule. Remember last week, you can imagine Jairus going along. I mean, if anyone wants to keep to a schedule, it's him. He needs to get Jesus to his house to heal his sick daughter. And Jesus just decides to stop. Have a moment with this woman. Heal her. And I can imagine Jairus saying, Jesus, what about the schedule? Isn't that how we often are too? How often do we feel like Jesus is too late? Or too early? Or just, I don't know, inconvenient? Lord, I don't have time for this conversation with this person right now. I've got better things to be doing. You understand, right? See, 18 years of suffering for this woman might seem like Jesus is late. But what Jesus asks us as our place as disciples is to surrender our time, not to seek to possess and own it, to control it. We surrender it to Jesus that he might use it, that our time might become his. Perhaps the more evident narrowness even in this passage is that regarding rules, as I mentioned. The Pharisees clearly had their rules. In fact, there was even debate among the Pharisees over whether one should pray for someone to be healed for the Sabbath. The rules had gotten so minute and detailed that they extended even to the thought life, to the prayer life of the people. And it's easy to look at the Pharisees and the ruler of the synagogue as fools, as people that just didn't get it. But imagine if I came to you and I told you, you know what, here's my command for you. Once a week, for one whole day, don't do any work. And I walked away. I suspect that you'd probably chase after me, and if you're not questioning my authority, maybe have these questions. Okay, Matt, what does that look like exactly? And to which I'd reply, well, I've told you. Don't do work. I mean, just remember the work that God's done for you. Okay, so can I cook? I've told you the command. Don't do work. Okay, well, can I garden? Just don't do work. That's the command. Don't do work. Remember God's work. Can I read a book? Don't work. Remember God. And you can understand the confusion that the simple commands can generate. But the command is simple. Don't work, remember God. And the temptation, in light of the grand freedom that God gives us, is to put rules around it. And this is the temptation we're all too familiar with. In the New Testament, we already see it. Paul repeatedly has to write to the churches and say, don't forget that you're not bound by this law. Christ has set you free. Live out of that freedom. And we have the same struggle today, too. As a first child of three, I'm very sympathetic to this problem. I'm a rule keeper. If you want to give me a task, I want to have all the instructions clearly laid out, and then maybe two or three examples. If you want me to paint a wall, I want to see how you hold the brush, because I want to do it right. And often we're like that with our spiritual lives, too. We want to get it right. So we feel like we need to share the gospel a certain number of times, pray a certain number of minutes, read the Bible for a certain period of time, and if you're really holy, maybe you'll get through the whole thing in a year. We make up our rules. It's quite natural because rules make us comfortable. But then Jesus comes in and just blows it all up. He says, hey, come follow me. What should I pack? I mean, what should I bring? Just come follow me. Okay, that's great, but where are we going exactly? Don't worry about that. Just come follow me. Okay, how far behind you should I walk? Is it like a mile back, or do you want me right on your ankle so it's really just come, follow me. The command of freedom. And in our passage, Jesus confronts the Pharisees and the ruler of the synagogue, even shaming them because their vision of the Sabbath and of life with God has become so narrow and confining that they themselves end up being bound. being tied to their rules, bound like the very woman that Jesus is freeing. And often we also end up bound. It's not that rules are bad or schedules are bad, but we can find ourselves tied to them, locked in the stall, unable to move left or right, unable to enjoy the grand park that God welcomes us to. Like the ruler of the synagogue, we can ignore the very work of God, turning to protest as the cries of rejoicing are behind us in anger. We've gone far beyond what Jesus ever wanted, the command of freedom. Come, follow me, be my disciple. It would be easy for me to stop here, I think. I mean, we could all go home a little earlier. And the reason is because if you're anything like me, you're very, very good at self-critique. I've had entire afternoons where, consisting of conversations between myself and myself that run something like this. Matt, why are you being so lazy? Why didn't you start this assignment sooner? Why are you not able to stay focused? Why are you asking yourself so many questions? Why? What are you doing? And it's very tempting to fit Jesus into this self-critical paradigm, isn't it? After all, isn't he being critical of the Pharisees here? Isn't that the main point of the passage? I think the context of the passage actually points beyond just the criticism. See, these miracles, these healings, are not ultimately just to shame his enemies. This is confrontational Jesus. His gloves have come off. He is not messing around. But he's confronting for a point. And that point is to extend an invitation. See, throughout his story, remember the big story that Luke is painting, Luke is concerned with how Jesus interacts with the nation of Israel. And our passage, when we look carefully, is actually dealing with the same concern. The fact that Jesus calls the woman a daughter of Abraham suggests that she is in fact standing in for Israel and representing Jesus' great desire for Israel to free her, to straighten her, to allow her to worship and rejoice. And this invitation is extended to all. But the reality is that not all accept it. The ruler of the synagogue doesn't accept it. And so Jesus will continue to teach in between our two passages, warning that those who do not accept him will not be recognized by God. And then in Luke 13, verses 31 through 35, he laments over Jerusalem. But the lament is filled with longing. He says, "How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings?" Jesus has this deep, deep care for these people. He longs to bring them to himself. Our passage is more than just confrontation, friends. It is an invitation to respond to Jesus, to follow him, to become a disciple. And Jesus mourns the fact that there are people who will not respond like the crowd in verse 17, rejoicing at his glorious works. In the midst of this invitation to the broad, free life that Jesus brings, we encounter a funny thing if we read a little further down the page in chapter 13. See, in verse 23, after Jesus has seemed to be critiquing the religious leaders for their narrowness, he then commends them to strive to enter through the narrow door. Huh? I mean, this is a strange saying. Certainly seems to go against everything that we've just been reading. So is this the same kind of narrow we are supposed to avoid? The language here, I think, reminds us of Jesus' other words about himself in the book of John. "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture." See, Jesus himself is the entryway. Jesus himself is the narrow gate. So the exchange here is not for one set of narrow rules for a different set of narrow rules. It is a shift from narrowness to the freedom of personal relationship. The narrowness of the religious leaders is a narrowness created in order to control and hold on. The narrowness Jesus calls us to is that of complete surrender to him. I'll say that again. The freedom that Jesus calls us to is the narrowness of complete surrender to him. But friends, a surrender to him results in the greatest freedom ever. It's the freedom of a woman standing up straight for the first time in 18 years. It's the freedom of a man healed from abnormal swelling. It's the freedom of entering green and lush pastures and being led by still waters. It's the freedom of a resurrected king and friend who loves, guides, teaches, and calls us. And this freedom, this glorious freedom, can only be reached through the person of Christ. See, these passages are more than just another healing. They're more than merely a critique of our preoccupation with schedules and rules. These stories are more than an opportunity for Jesus to rise triumphant over his enemies. These stories remind us that even in the very midst of our narrowness, when we have our blinders on, and see the world so narrowly. In the very midst of this, Jesus comes to us, and he says, "Come, follow me, be my disciple." "But I've spent all this time, Jesus, doing things the wrong way. Do you understand that? Come, follow me, be my disciple." But I mean, really, like, you, I put you in my schedule. I only give you 15 minutes a day, maybe an hour on Sundays. Come. Follow me. Be my disciple." "But I'm a Pharisee. I'm playing in the mud, Jesus. Do you understand that? I'm just playing in the mud. Come. Follow me." And Luke reminds us that Jesus, as he offers this invitation, is on his way to the cross. And Jesus takes our hand in the midst of our stammering excuses and points and says, "This is where I set you free. Don't tie yourself back up. Here I am. Come, follow me, and be my disciple." Will you pray with me? Father, this is glorious freedom that you invite us to. And so we ask this week, as we seek to live out that freedom, free from the narrow rules that we create for ourselves, that you would give us wisdom and give us a growing love for you. Help us to hear your words, to hear your call, and to look to the cross that makes it all possible. In Christ's name, amen.